Street in Champaign. Their number 217-352-3333 and 1907 West Springfield Avenue. Their number 217-352-9992. You can order online at jetspizza.com. Disability Beat is also sponsored in part by attorney Baku Patel of Patel Law, who practices Social Security disability law and represents those who have been denied benefits. There are no fees unless Patel Law wins your case. You can contact Patel Law for a free consultation to discuss your Social Security disability case. Patel Law is located at 108 West University Avenue in Urbana with offices in Danville and Decatur. For more information, visit patellawteam.com or call 217-384-1111. And now stay tuned for Disability Beat.
My name is Mike Slager from CCAMR. You are listening to Disability Beat on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, community radio for East Central Illinois.
This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Nora Handler of the Illinois SIBS Network on her experience as the sister of three men with developmental disabilities. But first, disability news for the week of October 24th, 2016 from Disability Scoop and Inclusion Daily Express. A group of U.S. senators is pushing the Food and Drug Administration to finalize a ban on devices used to administer electric shocks to those with developmental disabilities in an effort to modify their behavior. Six senators wrote to the FDA Commissioner Robert Califf late last month asking the agency to approve a proposal that would prohibit electrical stimulation devices used for self-injurious or aggressive behavior. The letter is signed by U.S. Senators Chris Murphy of Connecticut, Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, Cory Booker of New Jersey, Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, and Al Franken of Minnesota. It states, quote, put simply, it is outrageous that this practice is allowed in the United States for this vulnerable population, and it should be stopped immediately. As such, we urge you to finalize the proposed rule as quickly as possible, end quote. Earlier this year, the FDA proposed a ban on the devices which use electrodes attached to the skin to deliver electric shocks in order to condition individuals not to engage in certain behaviors. However, the agency has yet to move forward with issuing a final rule. The devices are only known to be used at one facility in the nation, the Judge Rottenberg Educational Center in Canton, Massachusetts, which serves children and adults with developmental disabilities as well as those with behavioral and emotional problems. The Rottenberg Center has contended that the method offers a last resort for individuals with life-threatening behavior disorders, but disability advocates have largely aligned against the approach, calling it harmful and ineffective. In proposing to ban the devices, the FDA said it, quote, determined that these devices present an unreasonable and substantial risk of illness or injury that cannot be corrected or eliminated by labeling, end quote. FDA spokeswoman Deborah Kotz said that the agency has received the senator's letter and plans to respond to the lawmakers directly. She also said that the FDA is still reviewing public comments submitted in response to the proposal. Individuals with disabilities receiving Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, or other Social Security benefits will see a small increase this coming year. payments will rise 0.3% in 2017, the Social Security Administration said last week. The bump up is due to an automatic cost of living adjustment known as COLA, which is mandated by law and based on inflation. The increase, which takes effect in January, will mean more money each month for 60 million Americans on Social Security and 8 million receiving SSI, officials said. With the change, the maximum federal SSI benefit for individuals will be $735 per month, up from $733 in 2016. For couples, the highest federal payment will grow to $1,103 per month from $1,100. Many states provide additional funding to SSI beneficiaries, so actual payments could be higher. Despite the modest increase, the adjustment is greater than what was announced at this time last year. Benefits for 2016 were unchanged compared to the year prior. New research suggests that reciting Shakespeare and participating in other drama exercises can make a big difference for kids with autism. Children on the spectrum who took part in a 10-hour-long session of a social skills intervention focusing on theater techniques saw improved language skills and socialization, according to findings published recently in the journal Research and Practice in Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. For the study, 14 kids with autism aged 10 to 13 participated in an intervention known as the Hunter Heartbeat Method, which was developed by an actress at London's Royal Shakespeare Company. The children attended weekly sessions that included games based on William Shakespeare's The Tempest, designed to enhance eye contact, gross motor imitation, personal space, taking turns, and other social skills. During the meetings, participants had an opportunity to practice, receive feedback, and perform for each other. Mark Tessay of the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center is a co-author of the study. According to Tessay, quote, "These children are taught these core skills in a very relaxed and playful environment where it's almost like they're not aware they're being taught. Ultimately, children with autism showed significant improvement in their social skills and their ability to engage in social relationships," end quote. And finally, New York State employees stole cash from the personal accounts of people with disabilities to pay for everything from live shows and restaurant outings to Walmart shopping sprees, according to a report released Thursday by the state's inspector general. According to New York State Inspector General Catherine Leahy Scott, quote, "With disturbing regularity, we have seen the shameless preying on a vulnerable population by those charged with their care," end quote. The pilfering of cash accounts maintained by the New York State Office for People with Developmental Disabilities was described as widespread and prolific. The report highlighted findings from 10 separate investigations across the state and found inadequate accounting safeguards and outright thefts. A few examples include one developmental assistant who stole more than $250 from six residents in 2012 to take her own family to see a stage show. She attempted to cover up the fact that none of the residents went to the show by buying them souvenirs from the show and playing the movie DVD for them so they would be familiar with the story. She also used the residents' money to buy restaurant gift cards and fabricated restaurant receipts. As a result of the investigation, she was arrested and pled guilty to larceny and falsifying business records. Her plea required that she pay restitution to the victims and perform 100 hours of community service. Another employee for a group home was charged with stealing money from the personal accounts of seven residents in 2013. The investigation also revealed that the residents' personal items, valued at $820, also went missing at the group home. In late 2014, an employee pretended to use the personal bank cards of her group home residents outside Albany to buy Christmas gifts on their behalf. In reality, she used the bank cards on purchases for herself. The house manager for another group home stole nearly $7,400 from resident accounts to buy name brand sneakers, musical equipment, and a recliner, among other things. The thefts and improprieties were so common common and widespread that more cases of theft and abuse were reported to the Inspector General's office even while the report was being written, according to the release. The Office for People with Developmental Disabilities employs about 23,000 employees who provide services to approximately 128,000 New York residents with developmental disabilities in institutional and community settings. In response to the findings, the Attorney General made recommendations that the Office for People with Developmental Disabilities has agreed to adopt. Recommendations include more training for the handling and oversight of personal cash accounts and new audits to better track and determine how group home residents' money is being spent. And that's the news for this week.
Stealing, pretty mama, don't you tell on me. I'm stealing back to my same old used to be.
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. I'm Vicki Nyswander, joined today by my friend Nora Handler, who is very active in the state in so many ways. And I asked Nora last minute today to be on the show. I was going to play an interview that I did with her about 8 years ago, and the good sport that she is, she agreed to come on and update us on what's going on in her life and in the things that she's worried about in the state of Illinois and nationally in recent years. So welcome to the program, Nora.
Thank you, Vicki. Thanks for inviting me again.
No problem. So why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners a little bit, tell them about your situation, your family, and why you are so involved in disability issues here in Illinois and elsewhere.
Great, thanks. So I have three brothers with intellectual disabilities. If they were all diagnosed recently, they'd all be considered on the autism spectrum. And my parents have passed away quite a while ago. My dad, very young, in the 70s, he was only 46, and my mom, when she was 68 in 1998. All of my brothers lived with my mom at the time that she passed, and we often call ourselves the poster family for how not to do it, because we did not do future planning. My older sister and I, who are most involved with supporting our brothers, really knew nothing about the so-called disability system. We never met any other parents, siblings, family members that had people with disabilities. So when these things happened in our family, it was a huge crisis, and now it's been many years. It amazes me to think of how many, and yet the implications of not doing future planning, of not having knowledge about the disability system in Illinois, still impact us to this day, and it's 18 years later.
Yeah, so what has your journey been? Are you the only sibling without a developmental disability, or do you have other siblings engaged in this?
So I'm actually one of eight siblings.
Oh, big family.
Yeah, and so it's all of my brothers that have disabilities, and then I also have a younger sister who has a chronic illness and a mental illness. So four out of the eight with disabilities, but my older sister and I are the two that are involved, and my older sister and I are co-guardians for the younger two brothers, and then my sister Margaret is the rep payee for my older brother Marty, who is his own guardian, but we do some powers of attorney and support for him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the complicated family that I live in.
Simplifying what could be an all-day presentation, I'm sure.
Exactly.
So talk a little bit about what happened when your mom died. Was that sudden or was it something expected? And how did you handle that situation? What was it that you realized you didn't know right away?
Well, my mom started having some health problems a couple years before she passed away, and we had tried to kind of push her into, we knew a little bit, we knew that there was a waiting list in Illinois, and we didn't know if the brothers were on it. The younger two went to a day service. The older one didn't have a diagnosis at that point. But she was not receptive to that idea. And so what we did kind of, my older sister and I, was we kind of buried our heads in the sand and we're like, well, okay, she's not going to let us be involved. She essentially really wanted my older sister to come and move in to her home, even though she had a husband to the kids and stuff herself.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, she just wasn't willing to have anybody but family take care of her sons. And so we just waited in fear, but we didn't really educate ourselves. So when mom died, there were three men who had lived all of their lives with her, two with, you know, just a little bit of day services, and the other one with no services, and it was a huge crisis. And it took us a year and a half to figure out the first transition that we went through. And since then, my brothers have transitioned five different times, which is really not what anybody wants to deal with after they've lost their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And my older sister quit her job and then couldn't get it back. So her impact is lifelong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her retirement benefits, and she was a teacher, are impacted forever. We learned a lot the hardest way of you know, what you should do and what you shouldn't do.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because I think, you know, that is really the key information that I would like you to share with listeners today, because there are people out there who are siblings, and there are lots of people out there listening who are parents who maybe have taken the same approach that your mom did.
And I always want to say, you know, I don't want to be like, you know, judging or slamming my mom. It was a different time for the beginning of it. And she understandably didn't trust other people to take care of her family. So what we learned, you know, was the importance of future planning as an entire family. And my mom did have a trust. However, it was not a special needs trust. It was not the right kind of trust. So it actually caused a problem instead of helping, because two out of the three brothers couldn't be eligible for Medicaid.
Mm.
And, you know, we learned all about the things that we should have known in advance, and what a difference it would have made had we been connected to other people, even if she would have continued to say no, you know, this is all set up and this is the way it's going to be. And I know other siblings that are experiencing that. But if we had met other family members, if we had known about programs, we wouldn't have made some of the big mistakes that we made in the beginning. I think we would have saved years of time and countless thousands of dollars. If we had, you know, had all of that knowledge in the beginning. So it's one of the reasons that I do what I do, and that I'm involved in the organizations that I'm involved in is that I don't want other families to experience what we experienced.
Don't you think, Nora, that some of your mom's motivation might have been she wanted to protect her other kids? You know, wanted to protect you and your siblings that don't have disabilities from thinking that you had to be responsible?
I think that is the motivation of a lot of parents. I do not think that was the motivation of my mother. My mother believed that you take care of your own.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that it pretty much was our responsibility to step in. And as the older sister, which happens so often, that it was the oldest sister who should be the next person.
Right, right.
And so, you know, without saying this without judgment, that was not an uncommon thing.
Oh, not
back
at all.
Back then.
Yeah. Yeah. So what recommendations do you make to the families out there who are listening who are in a similar situation to what you are, or maybe someday soon? What things should they be doing? Where should they connect?
So for siblings that are having trouble speaking to their parents about these things, and it's a tough thing to talk about. Nobody wants to talk about end of life. And I know from so many parents that saying, I want to live one day longer than my kid.
Yeah.
And I get it, because I'm a mom, too. But even if your parents are not receptive to including you in their future planning, in their trust, and whatever, we could have done so much more just educating ourselves, so that even if it didn't start out great, we could have skipped a couple of bad steps. We didn't even realize that when my mom passed away, that my brothers were considered it was a crisis, and no one told us that. Even the day service that they were involved with, they all thought, "Oh, they've got siblings. They're really not a crisis."
Mm-hmm.
So there were so many things we could have done even if we couldn't have gotten her to, you know, do the future planning together. So what I do, and when I speak, when I started as one of the founding members of SIBS, which is chapter of the Sibling Leadership Organization, is to educate siblings as to what's out there, to connect siblings to siblings. Because one of the things that my good friend Don Meyer, who was the pioneer of sibling support and is the director of the Sibling Support Project, one of the things he says is that siblings have the longest relationship of their sibling, upward of 60-some years or more, more than parents.
Mm-hmm.
with their family member with disability, but they generally are not connected. Parents, once they get a diagnosis, are often connected to other family members. And that was my experience. I didn't meet another family member until maybe 6 months after my mom had passed away. And so what we're trying to do is connect those people way before they hit a crisis. And there are now so many wonderful sibling organizations, many things that didn't exist even when I first got hooked up to the Sibling Support Networks. Our organization, SIBS, was founded by a number of siblings here in 2007, and then we became a chapter of the Sibling Leadership Network, which is going to celebrate its 10th anniversary next summer at their sibling conference. And we now have SibNet on Facebook. We have SIBS Network, which is our local Illinois chapters group on Facebook. We have websites. I'm on the Arc of Illinois board, and I think we're up to four or maybe five siblings on the board, which is pretty awesome.
Ever-increasing numbers of SIBs on those important boards of directors.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. So what are the things that family members, that SIBs need to educate themselves on, and how many different ways are there for them to become connected? Do they have to plan on going to meetings regularly, or is it enough just to join the Facebook page? How would you recommend people get started in this area?
Well, there are so many things that are online now. So that's like a really easy way to start, mm-hmm. and to connect. And for Illinois, our Facebook group is SIBs Network. Our website is SIBSNetwork.org. The Sibling Leadership Network, all you've got to do is Google it. You can find that. All of those things. And what's awesome, too, is SIBNet on Facebook. That has, I think we're up to over 4,000 siblings across the country and even in other countries. And so anybody can pop on and start out with a little dipping of the toe.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, go from there. There are sibling conferences in next June. The Sibling Leadership Network conference is, as I said, celebrating their 10th anniversary, and that's going to be in Hartford, Connecticut, in June 24th and 25th. Locally, what we try to do is connect siblings face-to-face, and it's an amazing thing, as I know, Vicki, you know, as a parent, to interact with people that just get it immediately.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, and so when I first met another sibling that wasn't one of my birth siblings, it was just an amazing thing, and those people tend to become your new best friends. So there are so many fabulous ways now. If I had what exists now back then, I can't imagine what a difference it would have been for me, for my brothers. You know, you don't want your family members to go through five transitions in 15 years.
No, absolutely not. And, yeah. You know, to be able to talk to people and figure out ways of avoiding that and gathering the information you need is so incredibly valuable.
And it is just so fulfilling to be with other people that are just like you. And, you know, it benefits our brothers and sisters so greatly. One of the things that we pride ourselves in our local SIBs and in our national SIBs group is that we work together with our siblings, with self-advocates, to form a important organization that benefits the whole family.
Yeah. So if people want to find out more about the SIBs network or SIBNet, where do they go to find that?
So on Facebook, we're SIBNet. On Facebook is the big international one. For Illinois, it's SIBs Network on Facebook. Our website is sibnetwork.org. And you can just Google Sibling Leadership Network if you want to be involved in the U.S. Sibling Leadership Network.
And I'm thinking just as valuable for parents to get involved with this as for siblings, is it not? I mean, they can learn a lot about how to deal with their kids.
Yes, I mean, there are some sibling groups that are literally closed to parents.
Mm-hmm.
SIBNet on Facebook is only for siblings because sometimes they want to be able to say, my mom and dad won't let me in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are some things that are a little bit closed. But yes, we call it siblings and sibling supporters.
Awesome.
And so, you know, especially our local website, and, you know, it also vice versa. I get on, the Illinois parents groups, and, you know, it's great to network back and forth between parents and siblings, and, it's beneficial for all of us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining me today, Nora Handler of the SIBS Network and SIBNet.
Thank you.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are podcast on our website at www.disabilitybeat.com or go to Facebook and look for Disability Beat Radio. Please send your comments and show ideas for guests or topics to disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Hope you have a great week.